We are back on Radioactive. Joining us now, she is a 2015 Equality Utah Ally of the Year, also a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah, and currently the U's Interim Associate Vice President for Equity and Diversity, Dr. Catherine Bond-Stockton. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Oh, and thanks for being here. So I want to jump in here. You won the university's Rosenblatt Prize for Excellence, mm-hmm. 2 years ago?
Yes.
That's one of the most prestigious awards, I'll say, at the U, I think.
They say so.
Well, you can be humble, but it's a big deal. You research issues of gender, sexual orientation, and again, over my lifetime, we've certainly seen queer studies go mm-hmm. from 0 to 100.
Yes.
But I'm just intrigued now that here along the Wasatch Front, we have the leader for the Salt Lake City mayor's race is an mm-hmm. out woman. We have an out man on the city council. Mm-hmm. You're over here on this sort of theory side.
That's right.
But in real life, all this gender fluidity is right in front of us.
Yeah.
I mean, what's so rigid isn't so rigid anymore.
Very, very true. Very true. I think it's exciting. So I came to Utah in 1987. I like to say I was a queer pioneer and actually sort of came to be a missionary to the missionaries, because coming here surprised me as much as anybody that I decided and really chose out of the available job possibilities to come to the University of Utah, which was shocking to my advisors at Brown University. Thought I was going to go to NYU and accept that job. That seemed more likely. But I thought this would be a great place because I wanted to come to a new place, new land, new beliefs, and really challenge myself with what I might find here. And it has been wonderfully challenging, broadening for me.
And this has been, issues of gender, sexual orientation has been your main research ever since?
That's right. And okay. I was hired actually in a position called gender theory, which was very forward-looking. You think that was 1987.
In Utah.
And theory was just coming into many English departments. Everybody kind of had to hire a theorist, but it didn't mean that they had to mark a position called theory. And to have a position in Utah called gender theory was pretty exciting. So in many ways, I'd like to remind my listeners that many of the things we've been teaching at the university, really going back to the early 1990s, 1990 is really sort of set roughly as the birth of queer theory. And now it's very gratifying. It's very exciting. It's actually very humbling to see the general culture, you could say, catch up or really sort of understanding that that's where they've always been. But nonetheless, the types of academic things that we were so charged up by and with, the 1990s are really coming to a place where the general public is ready to hear and debate and be entangled with us.
I mean, the U's an R1 school, a research institution. Doesn't sound like you had much trouble landing and fitting in.
No, strangely, is one of the great things about Utah. And it may be, I have a degree from Yale Divinity School. So I came very interested in religion and why folks believe what they believe, and feel a deep sense of respect for the way that people come to attach themselves to religion for all kinds of reasons. Always good to remind ourselves of that. Religion serves many complex purposes. And so I wanted to come and really hear from my students what things mean to them.
Religion, connect religion and gender for me. I mean, many religions seem extremely rigid, dominant religions throughout the world. Many are quite rigid in terms of what men and women should or ought or must do.
Sure. It certainly has been that way from the standpoint of organized religion. I'll just stick very quickly with Christianity because that's the religion that I've studied in a theological context and know best. But if you really think about it, Christianity is such an interesting example of being, what we would call a deconstructive religion. Very spiritual, very material. This idea that God comes down in the form of a servant, in a human body and lives a bodily life. And yet, of course, many people think that Christianity sort of became against the body. And in terms of church history, it certainly did. No reason to do so. On the one hand, Christ is considered to be a man, and that's why some religions feel that, or some denominations feel that women can't hold the priesthood. Nonetheless, we must remember that Christ is a very sort of feminine figure, body full of holes, and the holes in the body are the relevant point. It's also said that Christ sort of substitutes for the bride of Christ, which is the church, and taking on the sins of humankind. So in that way, Christ is the bridegroom, but Christ is also the substitute bride.
Wow.
So tremendous gender confusion, delightful gender confusion right at the heart of Christianity in its most orthodox way. Christianity is a very gender-fluid religion in its conception of godhood. And that may be important always to remember.
You're blowing my mind here. I mean, do we get into stigmata and bleeding?
Well, we certainly do go there. No question about that. And of course, Christ as an unmarried figure, you know, famously kind and embracing of prostitutes. And yet the book of Revelation is all about the bride and the bridegroom coming back together. It seems to be a heterosexual marriage. But what type of marriage is that when the entire church, right, has to be deemed as feminine is the bride? So all these very sort of patriarchal figures are actually feminine as the bride of Christ, but they're hooking up with Christ, who supposedly is the bridegroom, but as we've seen, is a substitute bride. So if that doesn't bend your mind, I don't know what will.
So no wonder we needed the Catholic Church to figure it out and tell everybody what to do.
Yes, and of course, the Catholic Church is a very interesting instance. I will, you know, maybe hazard a fence here by saying, you know, kind of a gay organization run by gay people against gay people. It's a very strange thought. Very gay clergy in many cases, at least many of the folks that I've known.
I mean,
over
we could
the years.
Make jokes about the
priests
wardrobe
and
everything. We don't have to do that, right, to get there.
No, absolutely not. And I really actually make that point respectfully by saying I've certainly known lots and lots of Catholic clergy and lots of gay Catholic clergy, some out, some closeted. So I think it's a very interesting instance of a celibate clergy, having very intense thoughts about human sexuality.
We could talk about nuns, too, for that matter.
Absolutely.
There's so much to talk about. I'm very intrigued. Something else you work on, and again, I don't know if society's quite there yet, and these things are so much in flux as we see all this change happening, but this notion of racialized gender is fascinating to me, and it seems something that maybe the gay and lesbian community is facing more forthrightly than the straight community? I'm not sure.
Well, interesting question. I don't know how to add that up. But nonetheless, I think what's so important is when we say these terms, you know, race, gender, sexuality, they sound very contained each in, you know, unto themselves. But of course, when one starts thinking about it, there's no way to have race without gender or sexuality without race. It's, you know, all sexuality is racialized in the sense that it's being performed and fantasized in relationship to bodies that are profoundly racialized, really globally, but quite intensely, obviously, in the U.S. idiom. So it is to say, I think we've known for a long time, famous books like Ain't I a Woman, written by African-American women are basically saying that the way that woman was defined was already defined in such a way that it was white gender and a white definition of woman that a black woman who even considered herself to be a normally feminine black woman felt boxed out of in some way. You know, Eldridge Cleaver writes the famous book in 1968, Soul on Ice, in which he creates four different types of categories, you know, one for the black man, one for the black woman, one for the white man, one from the white woman. And I use those terms very explicitly. And then basically ask the question, you know, who really is my opposite? If opposites attract, is my true opposite, if I'm a black man, a black woman? Or is my truer opposite a white woman if I'm a black man? Or maybe even my truer opposite is a white man in relationship to a black man? It's a really profound book. Cleaver was a very homophobic Black Panther figure. Nonetheless, his reading of American race is intensely sexualized, as one would expect it would be. And really gets at this profound issue that there's never been one version of a man or a woman. A black man or a black woman historically, you know, was really configured as a different sex gender category in many ways.
Especially when the white dominant culture had such an ability to make those definitions up, right? And to push
Absolutely.
Them onto people. I mean, we haven't even talked about indigenous culture, male and female roles, or Asian Americans or Latinas.
Absolutely. I mean, and now that fortunately we're getting to a place in U.S. culture where we're no longer seeing race just in terms of the black-white binary, not to undersell the force of the black-white binary.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that quite recently. But nonetheless, fortunately now we are constantly thinking about, you know, lots of different racialized categories, which are also changing all the time in really intriguing and important ways.
I mean, that takes us one step closer to something else I wanted to ask about, and that's this notion of racialized attraction.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, absolutely.
If you only want to date this or that kind of person. Is that racist or is that just, well, that's just what I like?
Yeah.
How do we parse that?
Yeah, I'll give you an interesting example of that, which I think really may help, you know, your listeners think this through. So again, going back to Cleaver, which was fascinating about him, is at the beginning of the book, Soul on Ice, he really feels, he defines himself as a sick man, because as a black man, he feels so intensely drawn to white women. And through the length of the book, then, he tries to cure himself, he considers, you know, of this sickness. So whatever one makes of those terms, that's very, very complicated politically and very problematic. Nonetheless, what's interesting in the book is sort of his understanding that this intense draw to white women is an attraction that history has put in his chest, as he puts it, which is to say, if you think about people pedestalizing white women, then in many cases, you know, white folks set up the conditions, you know, to sort of almost require that black men, that anybody find white women attractive so that they are, you know, enthroned, as it were. And then, of course, white folks turned around and called black people sick for wanting to be attracted to white women.
The very thing
called
they
that
set
miscegenation.
Up.
Absolutely. So it's a perfect example of where we see that an attraction sort of has these very deep historical causes and parameters. And may help us to understand that many of the attractions that we feel probably have, you know, deep historical context. You know, early feminists, right, wrote about that, compulsory heterosexuality. You know, if you're a female assigned at birth person and you grow up desiring boys or men, it's going to be hard to know whether that's something you really are choosing, whatever in the world that word means, you know, or whether that's something that's so compulsory that you've been deeply trained to have that attraction. I mean, this is one of the things we simply don't know. We don't know the answer to this, you know, medically, scientifically, biologically, culturally. These are some of the intense mysteries that surround attraction.
I mean, there's certainly a lot of research about that. I mean, there's research, at least as preliminary, that folks who are transgender, their brains operate somewhat differently. Is it really important to have a why, do you think?
Yeah. So I think those arguments, though very interesting intellectually, you know, have to remain somewhat open, it seems to me. I so utterly respect when somebody says to me, I feel I was born this way. You know, I can say that as a queer child, as a ghostly gay child. You know, I grew up feeling that my deepest, most natural tendency was to be drawn to other girls. So that felt very natural to me. On the other hand, I also sort of felt like I was a boy, that a mistake had been made. So the complication is, as I often say, if you started my DNA up now, would I be trans? I'm not sure.
Oh, wow.
I could also call myself a non-transition trans person. I didn't make that transition because I will tell you, in the time that I was growing up, there was no available concept for a female assigned at birth person becoming a boy or a man. You know, I knew, I had read of instances where so-called men, you know, became so-called women. I had read about that type of transition, but there didn't seem to be any concept going in the other direction. So I did not transition.
I became a lesbian,
funny enough, which was not how I thought of myself. I thought of myself as a normal boy who was drawn to girls and a normal man in love with women. But nonetheless, because I was being defined as a girl and as a woman, I ended up being a lesbian.
And you're thinking about all this as a kid, as a teenager?
Very consciously. I will tell you, very consciously. And I think it's one of the mistakes that we as adults make, to think that children don't have very savvy, in-depth thoughts about these things in childhood. I think there's a real spectrum. I talk to other folks. Some people say, I was about age 8 or 9, or maybe it was 15 when I began to think this. But many of us will say we felt these things, whatever these things were, in childhood, and then began having relationships with words. So I could say that one of my earliest relationships was with the word gay and with the word homo, hearing that and thinking like, uh-oh, that's going to be me. Even though I didn't think that was me.
Were you growing up in a supportive environment, something you could talk about with mom or dad?
I had two very loving, left-leaning, democratic, Unitarian parents.
Back to religion.
Nonetheless, yeah. You know, they're both right now in their mid-80s, incredibly supportive and loving, you know, now. I can't say that it was easy for them, you know, when I came out. It took some adjustment, as it would for people just from a different generation, for whom these concepts were very new and somewhat shocking. nonetheless, I had a very loving household context. But it's not like my parents were going to let me be a boy. Yeah. You know, I was actually kind of a boy by night and a girl by day. So my parents were very embracing of my need to run around and be boy-like and dress as a boy after school, but going to school and even by, you know, law at that time, I don't know if it was actually law, but yeah, the Board of Education required girls to wear dresses. So, I mean, I had to wear a dress to school and be a girl at school. Well, I was a boy at recess and a boy at night.
Oh, interesting.
So I think, you know, many of us grow up with this sort of dual consciousness or multiple consciousness. And that may be just true for lots and lots of kids. I don't think that's necessarily just true for gay or trans kids. Though I think we gay and trans kids are a kind of intensified, dramatized version of what many different kinds of kids go through.
So in a couple minutes we have left, what advice would you give to parents?
Well, boy, there's a lot to say there. I would say I understand that we are still in a time period where when kids come out of the birth canal, we're still marking them as girls and boys. So I understand we're doing that. So if that's what we're doing, then I think really a deep-seated commitment to listening when your child becomes a creature in language would be a wise thing to do. Keep your ears open. Listen for narrative. Don't see these terms or these categories as things that are just lowered like cones down upon your child, even though I do believe that's what we're doing. And I wonder how quickly as a culture we may get down a path of deciding not to do that at birth, to listen to what children say as they become people in language. I think maybe we'll have more categories available for them than strictly girl or boy. But I think for now, deep-seated listening, a commitment to narrative, listening for fit and misfit to the terms assigned to children would be a way to go. I think the terms female assigned at birth and male assigned at birth that come from trans folks are incredibly helpful for our discourse because it's a reminder that it's an assignment at birth that somebody may choose against or may feel deeply does not fit them. That may be important as we go.
Yeah, I mean, just listening, you could be in a place where you wouldn't buy your biologically assigned daughter a pink bike, and you might do them a world of good by buying them a blue one if you listened.
Right. And so I think that listening is going to be critical. I think that's true about sexuality, too. This may be the harder thing for parents. I think we're in a moment of understanding trans kids maybe a little more than gay kids because of the sexuality presumed that sticks to gayness. That's complicated, too.
Well, when you come back, we'll have to get into that, because if we go there, then we're into shame and we're into guilt. And
I wrote a whole book on shame, so I'll be ready for shame.
And I understand you have a new book coming out, Reading as Kissing?
Well, I'm working on a book called Reading as Kissing, Sex with Ideas. Be happy to come back and talk about that, too. The very strange state of reading, that reading is far more erotic than we may imagine. It is highly bodily and corporal, and there's a lot to say about what that might be.
And you're totally on the cutting edge of all this stuff.
Oh, I hope so.
No,
I try.
Totally.
I try.
No, when that book comes out, I want a copy and let's talk about it.
Sounds great.
So thank you very much for being here. Dr. Catherine Bonstockton is one of four 2015 Equality Utah Allies of the Year. She's also a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah and currently the interim associate vice president for equity and diversity. Thank you very much for taking time.
Such a deep pleasure.
Radioactive, produced by Laura Jones each and every week. You can hear all our Radioactive shows. Check it out online, krcl.org. And while you're there, leave a comment, share an idea, maybe give us an idea for a future show. Radioactive@krcl.org. Next up on your Community Connection, Ethnosphere. This is Nick Burns.